The latest on the Zika virus and other vector-borne diseases. Zika is all over the news these days. Public health officials are scrambling to track its spread. Scientists acknowledge that there are still lots of questions about Zika and about the threat to pregnant women living or traveling in areas where the disease has been confirmed. Zika isn't the only disease spread by mosquitoes and other vectors that have public health implications in the world today. An outbreak of dengue fever in Hawaii prompted the state last week to declare a state of emergency for the Big Island. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll talk about how public health researchers measure the threats of these diseases and how they try to contain outbreaks while also preventing new ones. We'll also discuss the efficacy of trying to curb or even destroy mosquitoes and other hosts of these vector-borne diseases. Maine Calling next. First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, so far there have been no cases of a person being infected with the Zika virus from a mosquito bite here in the U.S. But that doesn't mean it can't or won't happen as the weather warms. Today we're going to learn more about the Zika virus and other infectious diseases and what you can do to protect yourself once mosquitoes start to reappear. With me in studio, Dr. Rob Smith. He's co-director of the Vector-Borne Disease Laboratory at the Maine Medical Center Research Institute, and Charles Lubelzik, who is a vector ecologist at the Maine Medical Center Research Institute's Vector-Borne Disease Laboratory. Thank you both for being here today.
Yes.
And I guess, of course, as always, we want to hear from you. The number to join the conversation today is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. I want to start the conversation, I guess, with Zika, and maybe Rob will start with you because it's, as we said, it's in the news today. And one of the, I guess, the focuses of the articles that we're reading is about the spread, where it is, where it's moving to. And of course, here in the States, we're most curious about that. But what can you give us a sense of kind of where it's moving and at what speed?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to look at Zika virus in the context of a series of infectious diseases, and particularly mosquito-borne infections, that have marched around the globe in the last 10 to 15 years. And so we've seen, first of all, dengue fever, which had been relatively confined 20 years ago, spread around the subtropics and the tropics, and then diseases like chikungunya virus, which hit the Caribbean in 2014. Of course, we had West Nile virus here in 2000 in the Western Hemisphere for the first time, and that's here to stay. And so Zika is sort of an also-ran in a sense, and it's the latest of a trend of movement of vector-borne diseases to new areas. And it's not a new virus. It was actually, amazingly to me, it was found by researchers looking for yellow fever in Uganda in the Zika forest, who found this virus infecting monkeys. And we're beginning at that era, they were isolating viruses all over the world and finding a number of these things that we never knew we would see in other parts of the world. So Zika was kind of tabled away as an interesting arbovirus, continued to spread and cycle in Africa and Asia over the subsequent 50 years or so. And then an alarm bell went off in around 2007 when it went through an island in Micronesia and essentially infected everybody in the island. And this kind of caught researchers' attention. And then island hopped right through the South Pacific over the subsequent years into Tahiti and Bora Bora. And finally, last spring, in April, appeared for the first time in South America, in Bahia, Brazil. So this virus in the last few years, 5 years or so, has moved fairly quickly from the South Pacific to South America. And now, as you know, it's in something like 20 or maybe more now, 30 countries in Central and South America and some of the Caribbean countries as well.
So what makes a virus like this that's been around for 50 years suddenly take off? I mean, the conditions haven't really changed. What are the factors that go into a spread like this?
Well, clearly movement of goods and people around the globe at a much faster and greater rate is one major factor. The other is that you have the substrate for these viruses to take off. And Chuck will probably get into this, the key mosquito for several of these viruses likes to live next to people. It likes to breed in containers like plastic and tires, and it likes the tropics. And so if you have the situation where you have an increasing number of these mosquitoes, increasing breeding sites for them, and a population that's also burgeoning, you have all of the ingredients for this to take off once it arrives in a new site.
Chuck, is that it? Is it the vectors, the increase in vectors that are, or the micro, or the organisms that transmit this that are the reason for the spread?
Yeah, I think a lot of these viruses are directly tied to mosquito populations. And what we do see, we have mosquitoes that are now, because of human activity, getting in water bodies and container ships in tires, and they're being transmitted across continents and over continents to new areas. In the U.S., we do have several new, what we call exotic or invasive mosquitoes that have appeared in the last 15 to 20 years. Some of these are more problematic than others, but the same situation is happening in response to things like Zika and chikungunya virus as well.
So we tend to think of very, very simply, I think, here in Maine, for example, that, you know, mosquitoes are mosquitoes. They're nuisances, but they aren't, and some are more apt or more more of an affinity for being carriers of these diseases?
Yeah, depending on the disease, some are much more adapted to certain diseases than others. And of the 45-plus species that we have, we find there are really 7 to 10 that are of public health or veterinary importance within Maine. But, of course, worldwide, there are many more species that can cause either human or animal disease to the populace.
So is there a barrier in the United States, for example, above which Zika would be less likely to go because of the types of mosquitoes that are indigenous?
Yeah, the principal vector for Zika, as well as chikungunya virus, is a mosquito called Aedes aegypti, and it's very much a tropic mosquito. They do have it cycling in the far lower reaches of the south. So, for instance, Key West would be an area where you'd see Aedes aegypti. Also areas of Puerto Rico as well, and it also is found in the southwest. There's another mosquito called Aedes albopictus, or the Asian tiger mosquito, which is a bit more temperate. And that one is one that is suspected to play some role. It's really unclear right now how definitive it is. But that one is more temperate, so it will reach New Jersey, lower New York, cycling now in Connecticut, and it's also now in the last 2 or 3 years found its way into coastal Massachusetts. It's not really well adapted to winter, so we don't think it's cycling here yet in the extreme northeast, but we don't know how it's going to play out down the road.
And the questions about, of course, sexual transmission now would mean that everyone was capable of being exposed here, regardless of mosquito populations.
Well, I think that's a little more rare than the mosquito-transmitted version. I mean, Rob can probably speak to that more.
Sure. I mean, I think that when you get a viral infection like chikungunya or Zika in this case, you're carrying a lot of virus in your blood for about 7 to 10 days, and the virus gets deposited in other parts of the body. And the new information with Zika is it does appear that there were 2 or 3 cases which sound quite convincing that sexual transmission of the virus from probably semen from male to female occurred. How often this occurs is really not at all clear. And the finding of virus in other body fluids doesn't necessarily correlate with transmission much of the time. So I think we still need to learn, is this a very rare event or is this something that will occur with some frequency? If so, is it how long is the risk period? Is this something that's primarily risk when there's a lot of virus around for the first 7 to 10 days, or is it something where risk persists as long as you can detect the virus? We just don't know.
And among the other things, it's not known either, although much is being written about it, and there is some evidence of the connection between birth defects and Zika, microcephaly, one of the conditions. But I'm reading in recent days that that's, it's not completely clear. There's strong evidence or belief that the virus has been found in as a link. But what can you say as of right now about that connection?
Well, it's obviously a very concerning connection that's been drawn in particularly one area of Brazil where there appeared to be a substantial increase in microcephaly cases, which is babies born with smaller brains than normal and usually associated neurologic problems with that as well. And so this was associated just epidemiologically. And it also seems that as that went up, that those numbers may be dropping in that same state in Brazil. It hasn't been seen in some of the other areas where Zika has been recognized. So it wasn't noted, at least in the as Zika went through the South Pacific. There have been a lot of cases in northern South America, countries such as Colombia, where it has not been seen yet, although the virus arrived there later. So it may be too early for us to tell. That being said, there are several cases being accumulated that really do sound like they were caused by Zika virus. And Zika at least will likely join a list of infections that can lead to this kind of developmental problem. There are many different causes of microcephaly. So when you're doing these kinds of studies, you really do have to do careful clinical work and epidemiology and then try to figure out what the link is. I think there is going to be a link based on what you can read. How commonly this occurs due specifically to Zika virus as opposed to other viruses is not known.
What are some of the other health risks then, apart from this risk to unborn children, to just the average person or to at-risk people? What are some of the health effects that the Zika causes?
Well, the Zika virus is relatively mild causes relatively mild disease in most people who are exposed to it from what we can tell from prior studies. And usually it's a few days to a week of a flu-like illness with rash, joint pain and fever and headache, those sorts of common symptoms. And that is in two-thirds of the time people may have no symptoms at all. So a lot of people may be exposed and become immune from being infected but not have any symptoms at all. The one concern that has been raised and was actually raised in French Polynesia when Zika was first seen there was a possible association with something called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a kind of final common pathway neurologic problem where you develop weakness in your legs and it can ascend to your arms and then become life-threatening if you lose respiratory muscle function. So this is a syndrome that's been seen following a number of infectious diseases over the years and may be linked to Zika. But once again, we really don't know how commonly this occurs. When we see Guillain-Barré in this country, the commonest cause is actually a bacterial, when it's identified as a bacterial infection in the GI tract. But when you look at people who have that particular bacterial infection, one in several thousand of them may go on to get Guillain-Barré. So it's quite a rare occurrence even among the commonest trigger for it in this country.
And as you said, there's still a lot to be learned about Zika, and yet it's 50 years old. Was it just not an important or major public health concern, and that's why there was not a lot of research into it?
Yes, I think when you look at the global picture, you still have malaria causing 500,000 deaths a year, mostly in kids and in sub-Saharan Africa. And a lot of inroads have been made in the last 10 years or 20 years with malaria prevention and treatment, which has lowered the numbers. But that's still the big one in terms of morbidity and mortality. And then you have dengue fever, which causes something like 20,000 deaths a year, ringing the tropics, and that is basically unchecked, and for which we still have no vaccine and have relatively limited environmental approaches to preventing it. So when you go down the list, Zika's interesting and it's important. We don't understand all of its ramifications, but on the tally sheet of what's actually causing a public health threat, it's still further down the list. And the other side of this is that there's something like, I was actually astounded to read this number, but 500 different insect-transmitted or arbovirus-transmitted viral infections that have been recognized in nature. About 100 of them can cause disease in humans. And so there are many, many more viruses out there that are transmitted in cycles in nature that we really don't know anything about. And obviously our resources are going to be focused on what are the bigger public health problems at the time. But it's a cautionary tale for us as we see changes on the planet occurring at the rate they're occurring now, for all of the reasons that we're aware of, that we have to be thinking ahead and be proactive and thinking about what comes next and how do we investigate it.
Is part of that, Chuck Lubelzig, is part of that controlling mosquito populations, or is that not a realistic approach.
No, I think it is realistic. Some of it, though, for the spread of these diseases gets back to human mitigated transportation, though. So I think better control mechanisms in place for transport. You know, if you have container ships, if you have anything containing potential mosquito breeding water going across oceans, going to new continents, obviously getting that treated is important because you can help to stop or at least slow colonization. Once the mosquitoes are actually established, then pretty much you do have to do treatment of mosquitoes on the ground. In a lot of cases, this is not just a one-time thing, though. It's a program, and it's one that is going to be an investment for several years because certainly once the mosquitoes are established, they will keep reintroducing and cycling once their populations are in place.
All right. We'll talk more about some of the different approaches to controlling mosquitoes, and there's some controversy among this because I assume there's some risk also in using chemicals and that sort of thing in terms of controlling mosquitoes. But we'll talk about that right now. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we want to hear from you, your questions and comments today on this topic. The number, again, is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Clean Bedroom Organic Bedding Showroom, helping Mainers sleep healthy since 2004. Showrooms in Portland, Kittery, and at thecleanbedroom.com. And the World Affairs Council of Maine, presenting Arctic Matters, a breakfast program with senior Arctic official Julia Gorley. Learn more at wacmaine.org.
After having written a history of American secularism and a personal history of religious conversions in three generations of her family, Susan Jacoby has written a book called Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about atheism, religion, and conversion in private life and in politics, and why she became an atheist. Join us.
That's coming up this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. February brings us the annual Winter High School Basketball Tournament, and once again this year, Maine Public Television will be offering on-air coverage, and MPBN.net will be streaming online. This year, the final 10 games will be broadcast on one championship weekend. That's Friday and Saturday, February 26th and 27th. In addition, new this year, MPBN will be offering a repeat broadcast of all 10 final games statewide on both Saturday and all-day Sunday. That's the weekend of the 26th and the 27th. You can find the complete schedule online at mpbn.net. Regular viewers may want to watch Our World or Create television channels, and note that the Friday evening Downton Abbey repeat will be taking place Thursday next week only.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're talking about Zika and other vector-borne diseases. With me in our studio, two experts. Dr. Robert Smith is co-director of the Vector-Borne Disease Laboratory at the Maine Medical Center Research Institute, and Dr. Chuck Lubelczyk is a vector ecologist at the Maine Medical Center Research Institute's Vector-Borne Disease Laboratory. We invite you to join the conversation as well. The number is 800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. An email here, we know pregnant women should avoid traveling to areas where the Zika virus is. What about families with kids? Is it taking a reasonable risk to travel to these areas where the likely worst outcome is a fever, or is it best to avoid these areas altogether until we know more about Zika?
I think we know enough about Zika to not feel that it's a worse mosquito-borne disease than some things we already know are in many tropical areas. So the standard advice that we would give to travelers going to areas where these diseases such as dengue fever are transmitted would be to be aware of the kinds of precautions you can take against mosquito exposure or contact. And I would not discourage people from traveling simply because they've read that there's a Zika outbreak. As I said, there are other mosquito-borne diseases that we already know about that are there. And the more important factor is how you travel and the kinds of precautions you take to protect you and your family.
And has there been any talk, given all of the emergence of these diseases, about using stronger repellents on your skin or any other types of technology?
We have effective repellents. I think the issue is using them regularly. And what some people don't realize with some of these viruses is that they're transmitted by usually daytime biting mosquitoes. So the Aedes aegypti is a daytime biter, particularly at the end of the day or the early day, but any time. And it can be kind of a stealth mosquito. So just because you don't see a mosquito around in the area that you're visiting isn't a reason not to just put on your daily repellent. And I recommend travelers use a long-acting EPA-approved effective repellent that hopefully will stay on most of the day, reapply it as needed to, you know, use clothing that discourages mosquitoes. And one thing that a lot of people don't do that I think really can be helpful is to spray clothing with something called permethrin before you go on the trip, which strongly discourages mosquitoes from biting through your clothing. So you've got the skin covered, you've got clothing that's protective, and then that puts you in a lot better place than you would be otherwise.
All right, let's go to the phones to Eva in South Portland. Hi, Eva. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I have a question. I understand the virus survives in blood for 1 week, and in semen, I have read different things. I think 2 weeks is a pretty established opinion, but then I also read articles that say if you have been in the country, you should really use a condom for 6 months to be safe.
Well, unfortunately, we really don't know the answer to that question yet. The guess would be that it'd be the time when you're carrying the virus in the highest load, which is thought to be the first couple of weeks. But there's recently been a letter I just read about from some European researchers, I think going to be published in one of the journals, showing detection of the virus up to 60 days in semen after infection in one person. So we really don't know the answer to your question, unfortunately, at this point.
And Eva, the note here says that your daughter may be traveling to...
Well, my daughter and her fiancé, they are in Mexico, Colombia, Peru, that whole area for 4 months. And they're getting married in April in Hawaii, and they are trying to get pregnant. So...
Yeah, so are you asking whether they should wait or not travel?
Yes. Oh,
yeah.
Well, no, they are.
They're
going to
travel,
they
so
there.
Should they wait, I guess?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
for how long?
It's, you know, it's one of those answers we really don't have. If you asked me to guess, I'd say that that it's going to be a relatively infrequent occurrence that sexual transmission occurs. And when it does occur, it's you're really only ill with this infection for a week or two. So if you're I think it's the odds are against you getting in trouble if you think you're well. The trouble is that two-thirds of people may get infected and not know it. They may carry the virus when they're feeling well for a couple of weeks. So those are the kinds of it's just really guesstimates at this point as to what the real risk might be.
Yeah. Eva, thank you for calling. We'll go to Susie in Bath. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Keith. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
So I'm a pregnant woman. I'm going to be traveling. I'm just entering my third trimester. I'm going to be traveling to New Orleans next week for work. And my question is, at what point, if not now, should pregnant women who either live in South Florida or the Gulf Coast or those women who are pregnant and traveling to those areas where the mosquito does exist but there's been no local transmission reported, at what point should we be concerned or limit travel to those areas in the United States?
Well, I think we have very reassuring information on that score from what we've seen with dengue fever, which is common in Central America at times and up into Mexico. And CDC did an interesting study probably about 5 years ago where they looked at dengue rates on one side of the border and then on the other side of the border. And even though the vector was present in the southern U.S., the rates, you know, it's been very rare to see dengue fever transmitted. There was a small outbreak in South Texas with a small number of cases and a few in southern Florida at one time and then just disappears even though the vector is present. You need to have a fairly large number of people getting infected at once to keep an epidemic like this going. So I think with the heightened awareness of this problem that we'll know if this becomes an issue in the southern U.S. and certainly the history of what's happened with these viruses before would say that it's relatively unlikely. And some of this may be depend on what you're where you're living and what you're doing when you're in these places. So if you're in an air-conditioned or screened house, it's very different than if you're out doing field work in the same area. So the kinds of activities that put you at risk for mosquito contact are a big factor as well.
Yes. Susie, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. I guess that my other concern is about the fact that when most people are affected, it looks like 80% don't have symptoms. Just wondering if the experts thought that perhaps there was some local transmission and it just hasn't been detected yet in the United States.
Well, that certainly is a good question, and it could happen. In general, what we've been seeing with this virus is that when it starts being transmitted, you have a fairly rapid accumulation of cases, both symptomatic and asymptomatic. And at the same time, the CDC is involved in pretty intensive surveillance for, you know, both on the mosquito side of things as well as the human side of things for this. Everybody's well aware of the concern. So I would be pretty optimistic that they'll be on top of this.
All right, let's go to Peter in Cape Neddick. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Yeah, hi, go ahead.
This something I heard a couple of years ago, and it's rather a specialized application, but there may be places where those who are listening wish to use it, inventors, et cetera. And that was in Africa, where they had medical units, and they installed a series of lasers that could tune in on the female mosquitoes and shoot them down. And I know it sounds a little Buck Rogers, but I just thought I'd better get the word out there for those who might need some kind of a special application.
Sort of a Star Wars approach. Do you know anything about that, Chuck?
I know there's a lot of technologies people are devising to kill or mitigate mosquitoes. the one that we've heard about more is actually one that's used in Asia, where they actually will take sonic waves and they'll use those to blast ponds to kill larval mosquitoes. I think in a lot of cases these are very sexy for the news because it's a tech innovation, you know, that they're using to kill these mosquitoes. We have not heard too much about the laser targeting of them. The big thing that's been in the news more is sort of using genetically modified mosquitoes. So you create and breed a bunch of sterile males, which will then go and breed or attempt to breed with females. And the hope is that the overall mosquito population will lower as a consequence of that. And that really seems to be the big tech development right now.
Anytime you mess with Mother Nature in this way, though, red flags go up. There must be concerns about the long-term and unforeseen effects on the ecosystem from doing that?
Yeah, there is, I think, some people do have some concerns about it, but I think that overall mosquitoes are a very short-lived creature by and large. And so the idea that these genetically modified bugs will be hanging around in the wilds for a while is probably pretty unrealistic. You know, most mosquitoes on average live at most a month, perhaps a little longer if they're in really favorable conditions. But by and large, they tend to get culled out of the system pretty quickly. And so the idea of using these might have lower risks when weighed against the disease.
Let's go to Roger in Rochester, New Hampshire. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. And I think you've just answered my question. I called wondering because I've been wondering about since I've been reading about the virus, which is tragic, but also the efforts to eradicate mosquitoes and wondering about the effects of that on creatures who are dependent on it like bats and birds and how to balance the efforts to, eradicate the virus with the environment and the creatures that live off those things.
Yeah, so with a lot of the issues that we face,
when I was hanging on,
with actually introducing biological controls, which could be frogs, it could be dragonflies, are a very popular mechanism as well, but also bats as well as birds. Mosquitoes form some component of their diet, but and especially in the tropics, this is probably more pronounced. If you think about a bat flying around, and it has the opportunity to grab a very large moth versus a mosquito to eat. You know, the moth in many ways is going to look like a pretzel. The mosquito might look like a pretzel stick. the moth is going to be like a juicy burger for it to sink its teeth into. And so, you know, there is kind of a trade-off in what it's going to go for prey. Mosquitoes are probably some component of bats' diets as well as birds and dragonflies, but they also feed on a variety of other organisms. And so the overall impact might be not as high as some people suspect.
And the other aspect is the genetically modified approaches to mosquito control are targeting this one species of mosquito, which is a common species around households in the tropics. But they're really looking at the Aedes aegypti mosquito either through this a lethal gene introduction or through putting something called Wolbachia, which is a kind of bacteria, into that mosquito population, but that's appears to be specific for that mosquito. So there can always be unforeseen consequences of these things, but they're certainly trying to do it in a very targeted way.
The number is 800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Larry in Bangor in a moment, who's been waiting patiently. But still on the subject of mosquito control, we'll go to South Portland and Afton. Is it Afton?
Yes.
Yes. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I was wondering, I see in areas that are affected by Zika, they're doing widespread spraying of pesticides, and I'm wondering what effect that might have on the fetal development.
Yeah, so we haven't talked much about pesticides. You've discussed some other alternatives, but this is a somewhat controversial area, I'm guessing, since there are public health concerns around pesticides.
Yeah, I think some of the methods that they're using are going to be very targeted to water bodies. So, for instance, and what Rob mentioned earlier was that Aegypti, Aedes aegypti especially, but also the other mosquito, Aedes albopictus, are what we call artificial canister breeders. So they like to go in cans, buckets, water, the plastic disposable water bottles are a great breeding habitat for these mosquitoes, along with things like gutters, rain barrels, stuff like that. And so there is an aspect of this where you're actually very much targeting the individual containers. So it's very targeted and very low or minimal impact outside of those particular breeding containers. That would be probably the least environmentally harmful method of pest control on mosquitoes if you're applying chemicals. More concern is raised when they're actually doing the equivalent of like aerial or widespread spraying.
Or if you're doing roadside drains or something like that, yeah. All right. We are going to go to Larry in Bangor, I promise, but first we're going to take a quick break so we have time for his question or comment. The number to join us, 1-800-399-3566. Quick break. We'll be right back. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Silly's, and Silly's with a Twist in Portland's East End, open at 11, Wednesday through Friday, 9 on the weekends, with vegan and gluten-free options. Silly's.com.
The war against ISIS is no longer an abstract military operation taking place thousands of miles away. It's something confronting every American.
Just because you can't prevent, you know, every attack from happening, I'm not sure that that's a reason to not make an effort. I'd like to think that defeating the ideology that underlies some of this is a start.
Fighting ISIS at home and abroad, next time on America Abroad.
Coming up at 1 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Meet Kareem Saleem El Amin of Baltimore.
Went to prison when I was 18 in 1971. I served 42 years, 3 months, and 3 days. 2013.
And William Gardner.
I served 46 years and 5 months. Got locked up when I was 16.
Why did they and dozens of other Maryland lifers get out of prison, and how are they handling their freedom? Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, what we know about the Zika virus. With me in studio, Chuck Lebelzik. He's a vector ecologist at Maine Medical Center Research Institute's Vector-Borne Disease Laboratory. And Rob Smith is co-director of the Vector-Borne Disease Laboratory at the Maine Medical Center Research Institute. Joining the conversation, the number 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mbbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Let's go now to Larry in Bangor. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I would be somewhat concerned about using ultrasound to kill mosquito larvae and that you would kill other larvae as well. But that wasn't my main point. This virus has been known for 50 what odd years. It's somewhere in Africa, some forest there. and I have not heard of microencephalopathy being a problem there. Now, the AIDS virus has mutated a gazillion times. Flu viruses and cold viruses alter every year. That's why we take different shots every year. What's the possibility that the Zika virus has mutated, and that's the reason we're having this microencephalopathy problem?
Yeah. Rob?
I don't think there's any evidence that it's mutated, although I can't really answer the question of how much the viruses have been looked at that way. These days, we're pretty quick at getting molecular characterization of viruses, and sequencing is so relatively easy that you can form trees of relatedness of virus isolates from pretty quickly and see how much change there is. There's no evidence yet that anything is different about the genetics of this Zika virus than others. In fact, the techniques used to identify it in the blood, the test is actually looking for the RNA of the virus, and it targets it. From that target, you can then look at the virus and see if it's if it's changed or not. So, we may learn new things about how the virus looks, but we have no evidence of that yet. I would say that, let's say that microcephaly occurs at a low rate in pregnant women who are infected with Zika. You may have to really be looking for it to show the association. So it could easily be that if this is a relatively infrequent occurrence, that during a Zika outbreak, an increase in cases of microcephaly might not be noted unless people were really attuned to that.
Larry, any follow-up?
No, just I'm trying to figure it out like everybody else.
All right. Thank you, Larry. Let's go to let's go to Joe in Saco. Hi, Joe.
Well, yes, I'm calling. I think it's similar to the question that was just asked. Was there any microcephaly outbreaks when the disease was island hopping through Micronesia and so forth? And that was my question. Did anybody note that?
No, it was not noted in those outbreaks. And people, the CDC was actually paying pretty close attention to this process. There was a very nice article written by the late Ned Hayes, who was at Maine Roots and was working with the CDC at the time in 2009 when it was in the South Pacific, going through all the data, and people were looking at it. They didn't see that. It was noted that there was an increase in this Guillain-Barré neurologic syndrome in French Polynesia, but again, how much of a risk there was and how tightly it could be tied to the virus was not determined. But again, you're dealing with much smaller populations on most of those islands than you would be in a place like Brazil.
All right, Joe, thank you. Let's go to, is it Jick in Surrey?
K-I-T.
Yes. Oh, well, welcome to the program.
Another possible reason for a difference in the incidence of microcephaly might be that the adult population has never been exposed before. In Africa, presumably, if the virus has been there for many years, people would get infected as children, and they might have some immunity by the time they get to the age of becoming pregnant.
That's a very good point. And that's true that in places where a virus is circulating, the people who have been exposed to it multiple times probably have immunity, and it often is more of an issue for children who are not yet immune. So that's a very, very good observation.
Where it would tend to be a milder disease.
Right.
Yeah. Another comment is that I suspect that the health concern on this will increase. That maybe some microcephaly survive a long life, but have a very low IQ or life.
Your phone is not working for us. I'm not sure. Did you make out the question?
I heard something about IQ and development and microcephaly.
If babies with microcephaly survive a long time, but they have a low IQ and a lifetime severe disability because of small brains, I think that will increase the public health concern about this virus.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you for your comment and for calling us today. The number again, 1-800-399-3566. Gene from Bangor wants to know a simple question. What's the definition of vector-borne or vector spread? What's a vector?
Well, it would be an organism that would transmit the disease to us or livestock. So a vector for our case for Lyme disease, for instance, would be the tick. For West Nile virus or Zika, it would be a mosquito. would be the vector, be the mode of transmission that it comes from the nature into our population.
And I think it's just, you mentioned this earlier, Rob, that you know, one of you mentioned mosquitoes are a very common vector in this case. But as we know, ticks are also – are there other sort of vectors that we hear less about but that are out there and maybe they don't have as much contact with humans? But
Well, for humans and for our purposes in North America, it's really ticks and mosquitoes almost exclusively. In other parts of the world, there are other kinds of insects. Sand flies, for example, carry a kind of disease, leishmaniasis. And there are certain kinds, other kinds of flies that will be vectors in some parts of the world. And rarely we'll see a vector-borne disease that's related to something other than a tick or mosquito, but they're quite rare in the U.S.
And fleas we haven't heard
from. Oh, yes. Fleas.
Fleas are the big one in the Southwest, right. So plague. For
sure,
instance, or,
right.
or the Black Death would be the
right. Excuse me, we're talking a lot about Zika. You had mentioned chikungunya. Is that how it's pronounced?
Yes.
What can you what can you tell us about that, and what concerns we should have, or the extent to which it is a public health threat as well?
Well, chikungunya is another virus that was recognized first in Africa and again circulated in Asia. So it has sort of a similar history. And then appeared in the Caribbean a couple of years ago and really had very high attack rates. That is, most of the people on some of the islands in which it occurred were exposed to it, and there were quite a few cases. And that disease actually appears to be a more severe disease in that you get the same kind of fever and aches, but the joint aches can go on for weeks or months in some people after the infection has ebbed away. So that a virus can be quite problematic for some individuals. When that was in the Caribbean, I think in Maine we were seeing a few travelers. I think in 2014 there may have been five or six travelers who were diagnosed who acquired chikungunya during their vacations in the Caribbean. It's interesting. With a lot of these viruses, you see a big wave, an epidemic wave, and then the at-risk population becomes for the most part immune, and then it doesn't go away necessarily, but the transmission dies way down. So with chikungunya, it really swept through the Caribbean and into Central America and parts of South America, and it's continuing to smolder along, but we're not seeing the same attack rates in the Caribbean that we saw just a year or two ago. And hopefully we'll see that kind of pattern with Zika.
All right, let's go to Jody on the phone. Hi, Jody.
Yes, I would like to bring up an article published recently in The Guardian quoting a scientist named Dino Martins, who has looked at the incidence of microcephaly in Brazil and linked it to a larvicide called piriproxifen. The treatment of larvae is the most sensible treatment as opposed to adulticides, but BT is the preferred method, not piriproxifen, which is a teratogen, meaning that it causes birth defects, and it's also an endocrine disruptor. But that strikes me as the most likely possibility of all that I've heard, and it's obviously linked to Zika because in Brazil, as elsewhere, the efforts to control Zika have led to more and more powerful larvicides and other types of pesticides as the insects become resistant.
Yeah. Chuck?
Well, I think, you know, at its most basic, the easiest way to get rid of mosquitoes is to get rid of the breeding habitat by some means. And the point that Rob made, we were sitting earlier in the lobby, you know, someone made the comment that the plastic generation in a lot of ways has adapted these mosquitoes very well. It suits them well in urban environments because we have a lot of disposable plastic containers for these things to breed in. I think that the larvaciding, when it's done correctly, can be done very targeted. So you're actually applying, in some cases, drops to a particular small water container. You know, the hope would be that you're not drinking this stuff afterwards. Certainly, if you have, you know, cups, buckets, tires, things like that that are collecting rainwater, this is ideally what you should be targeting for mosquito control, would be these kinds of water bodies. Very small, in some cases, smaller than 8 ounces of water can sustain a mosquito population of hundreds of larvae at a time. We see in North America with West Nile virus, for instance, in urban settings, gutters on 3-4-story buildings with a lot of leaf buildup. They get clogged with rainwater. They become the preferred breeding habitat. So, you know, it's not, in many cases, a widespread reservoirs that you're hitting with this. You really should be targeting very discrete small areas for your larva sighting.
Yeah. Jody, you're referring, though, possibly to countries that are that may try to take a cheaper route or may not think through what they're doing as a way to deal with this?
I'm referring to the use of stronger and stronger insecticides as well, broadcast spraying as well as the larvicide that I mentioned. It's called pyriproxifen. It's dangerous because of the burst effects that it is linked to, that it is known to cause, and obviously is linked to the outbreak that no one seems to have any other explanation for in Brazil.
Yeah,
I think that's, you know, it's important to look at all of the potential factors when you're doing that kind of study. And I know that there have been a number of newspaper accounts around that question. It should be something that can be fairly easily looked at when they're doing good epidemiologic studies to see if there are other factors other than Zika infection that's led to increases in microcephaly in those areas of Brazil.
Let's go to Cheryl in Castine. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm curious. I actually had chikungunya this past year while I was living in the West Indies, so I can tell you it was a very intense disease to have. So I'm curious about a few things. One is whether or not there's any kind of immunity from having chikungunya to getting Zika. And also, how long, you know, I'm wondering, like, if I have a child, I have a daughter who's a teenager, if she's infected with the Zika virus, how long does that stay? Is it just like you have it and then it's gone? Or is there some sort of like chikungunya where I think you can get viral particles that sort of hang out in your system for quite a long time? And then the third question, is there some sort of interface between the Zika virus and what the caller previously had mentioned about the larvicide, because there's no evidence that it is showing up in the same numbers in other, like Africa, could there be some mutation that occurred in the RNA of the Zika virus as it was exposed to the larvicide?
Well, those are all, you know, good questions. The issue of immunity with chikungunya is not entirely known, I don't think, yet, because the experience, at least in the Western Hemisphere, was so recent. But we did see cases drop quite dramatically in a number of the islands once the virus had moved through. And that was what was seen in the South Pacific with Zika, was that a number of these islands, a number of people got sick, a number of people didn't get sick, but got exposed to the virus. And then it disappeared because they're just people weren't prone to get infected again. But now, how long does that immunity last is not known, and how complete is that immunity? We really don't know that, for as far as I know, for either Zika or chikungunya.
I think with the changes in the virus, for instance, chikungunya virus, when it came into the New World or the Americas, it encountered a mosquito called Aedes albopictus, which caused some changes in the chikungunya virus. Previously, it had been only in Aedes aegypti. You know, the fact that happened doesn't necessarily mean that because the Zika virus is bumping into a larvicide, that shouldn't change the virus overtly, because in many ways the larvicide itself is not affecting the virus. The virus is residing in the mosquitoes, which will be killed by the larvicide. So it's sort of like a 2 or 3 step process.
So we've got about a minute left here. Any final thoughts, I guess, about how the coverage of this is how the accuracy of the threat that's being reported here. Are we getting the best information we can, Rob Smith?
Well, I think that, you know, when there's a new virus, you have two sides of the coin. One is everybody wants to know everything that's out there as quickly as possible. And there actually are agreements among scientists to share information as rapidly as possible. The problem with that is, from the point of view of somebody trying to sort this out, is that you get lots of information that hasn't yet been vetted, or it hasn't been published yet, so researchers can't look at the quality of the research or critique it. So, you know, I think it's good that there's a lot of discussion about something like Zika. One of the as you stand back from these things, though, and you watch this occur, you realize that often we see these things come. There's a lot of interest in the media and the public, and then 6 months later, it's not a big deal, and we sort of forget about the fact that we still have dengue fever occurring around the tropics in great numbers. We still have chikungunya. We have all of these things that aren't going away, and we have other ones that may appear. And what I would hope we would be doing is, and I think probably we are nationally, is putting more money into sort of forecasting this sort of thing, trying to understand the ecology of what's leading to these outbreaks, and not just move from one to the next.
All right, Rob, Chuck, thank you both for being here. Appreciate it very much. Rob Smith, co-director of the Vector-Borne Disease Laboratory at Maine Medical Center Research Institute, and Chuck Lubelzik is a vector ecologist at the Maine Medical Center Research Institute's Vector-Borne Disease Lab. John Keimel ran the board today. Additional help from Sydney Campbell, who answered your calls. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling.